Inside Florida Politics, powered by Gannett. Hello, I'm Sarasota Herald Tribune political editor Zach Anderson, and I'm joined by Palm Beach Post politics editor Antonio Finns. Hey, Antonio.
Hey, Zach. Good to have you back.
Thank you. Good to be back. John Kennedy is off for a bit now, but Antonio and I have you covered with all the latest news. This week marks the end of July and the start of August, when school traditionally begins in Florida, and Governor Ron DeSantis has been out promoting the need for classroom instruction despite concerns that it's too risky with the virus raging. We'll talk about the growing debate over reopening Florida schools, a new Mason-Dixon poll that has Joe Biden leading in the state, President Donald Trump's remarkable call to delay the election in November and how that could play in Florida, and the possibility of a big financial crisis for many Floridians in August when federal unemployment assistance runs out. But first, y'all know what that music means, Antonio. You got a number for us today?
I do, Zach. I am going to go with 9.99.
Not quite 10 there, just a 1/100th of a point away. I'm up at 57. That's 9.99. 57 for me. Write those numbers down, folks. We'll tell you what they mean at the end of the show for Florida politics. Well, T.S. Eliot wrote that April is the cruelest month, but July was pretty cruel to Florida, with coronavirus cases tripling and COVID-19 deaths nearly doubling. Florida became a global hotspot for the virus, and the spotlight has been on Governor DeSantis, who has taken a hands-off approach to controlling this outbreak. Even with the virus raging, the governor has been arguing that it's essential to reopen schools in August. This week, he held a roundtable discussion at a school in Clearwater, where he argued that classroom instruction can be done safely and repeated his statement that he wouldn't be concerned about sending his own kids to school. But surveys show many parents are concerned about sending their kids back to brick and mortar schools. According to the Tampa Bay Times, the majority of Pinellas County parents, 60%, who responded to a survey, say they want to keep their kids home and do online instruction. Pinellas County includes the cities of Clearwater and St. Petersburg, and is one of the most populous in the state. That's a lot of kids who'll be learning from home, regardless of what the governor says about opening schools. Antonio, what does it say that most parents in this survey think classroom instruction is a bad idea, but the governor is pretty gung-ho about getting these schools open?
Well, it says, again, that we've discussed in the past, that he has a credibility problem and largely a self-inflicted one. Let's go back to the Clearwater event that he had on Wednesday. It was in a school, what it looked to be a school gymnasium. We had a bunch of adults talking about schools, how safe, how much they want to be back. But they were spread out in this gymnasium, you know, in different tables, at least 6 feet apart. The optics there said, hey, this is perfectly safe, but we're not so sure, so we're going to stay away from each other. The governor... The governor has, for whatever reason, when it comes to coronavirus, it's been one rush to judgment after another. In May, he told us we had this thing licked. By June, we were seeing an incredible spike in cases, particularly in the urban counties, where the largest sector of the population in Florida is based. And then in June, he told us, hey, it doesn't matter that there's a spike. We got plenty of hospital capacity. Well, in Miami-Dade and South Florida, that hospital capacity is going away very quickly. And in some cases, it's not there anymore. So these rushes to judgment, you know, it's okay to rush to judgment if you're right. But when you rush to judgment and if you're wrong, that's a different matter. And that's what I'm hearing. You know, here, the silver lining for me in this whole pandemic is that I go out and I walk. I get some exercise. I'm out there. And I live in a community where there are a lot of children. And we have a school not more than 2 miles away. And, you know, from a socially distanced position, every so often I'll ask the parents, hey, what do you think about schools? Look, the governor is right. Everybody tells me, well, I'd love to have my kid back in school. They say, oh, so you're sending him back to school. They'll say, well, not really. I think we're going to distance because of the reason people are scared. The governor continually asserts that there is no risk to children, that this is perfectly safe, and that there's no reason to fear that there will be community spread from children in school. But yesterday, Anthony Fauci, who, by the way, actually knows something about viruses and has a long record of devoting his life to this, he told the American Federation of Teachers, you know, that basically you're going to be part, quote unquote, you're going to be part of the experiment of the learn, you know, part of the learning curve of what we need to know. So Anthony Fauci is saying, hey, when it comes to kids in schools, we don't really know that much.
Right.
The governor is saying something very different. I think from what I hear, most people are willing to believe Anthony Fauci over the governor. That's a problem he's got.
Yeah, and the governor's attitude sort of seems to be, let's roll the dice. You know, the rewards outweigh the risks here. And that might be true for young children who are very low risk of, apparently, as you said, this is still kind of an experiment. We don't really know, but it might be true for you know, most kids. But if it's your kid, a lot of parents are unwilling to take that risk, and they're worried about themselves. They're worried about grandparents. They're worried about teachers. They're worried about everybody else in the community. And I was talking to a public health expert this week who said the big question, as well as are kids going to be safe, is how much could this cause this outbreak, which, you know, it's not quite clear, but it looks like maybe it's starting to plateau a little bit or maybe even decline, although the numbers are still incredibly high. They haven't been exploding like they were in the middle of July. So maybe we're starting to get a little bit of a handle on this, but you send kids back to school, and does that just put gas on the fire? And does that, even if the kids don't get really sick, do they spread it around? Does this outbreak become a lot worse in Florida because these schools are open? Because everything that we've been told is that the virus really, it likes an indoor environment, where people are close together, and obviously that's the definition of a school. It's very hard to maintain that distance. It's hard to tell kids to keep their masks on. So the governor seems to be willing to take that chance, and he has argued that that being out of school is very detrimental to kids, and there's no doubt about that. But a lot of parents seem to, according to these surveys, seem to think that it's more detrimental to potentially have their kids sick or to have this virus spread to others than it is to do distance learning for a while. So, we'll see. The governor did say this week that things could look a lot different at the end of August. And that is true. We saw the virus just totally change throughout July, and it really exploded. It's possible that it could be in much better control by the time we get to the end of August, when most schools are scheduled to start now. But there's no guarantee with that. A lot of school districts, especially those controlled by Republicans, appear like they're going to go forward anyway. So this is an experiment that is going to play out in Florida, unless he orders all the schools to stay closed, which seems highly unlikely. While reopening schools may be important for the economy and getting parents back to work, but there are still plenty of Floridians who will struggle to find employment in a job market that has been decimated by the coronavirus. They've been relying on an extra $600 a week in federal unemployment benefits to supplement Florida's meager $275 a week. But that federal money runs out at the end of the month, and Congress is sharply divided over whether to renew it, with Democrats in the House clashing with Republicans in the Senate. The disagreement is one reason why negotiations over another round of coronavirus relief have stalled, which means the federal unemployment benefit will expire, at least in the short term. There are roughly a million unemployed Floridians and many others on temporary furloughs who will lose this money, which amounts to billions of dollars that won't be flowing through Florida's economy. That could mean a big hit to consumer spending that would hurt businesses. And it could also mean many people could struggle to pay their rent and mortgage and put food on the table. Republicans, such as Florida Senator Rick Scott, believe the $600 payment discourages people from finding work because they're making more money off unemployment. But there are many others who argue that people simply can't find work because the virus has destroyed the economy. Antonio, how do you think this issue plays politically in Florida? Scott seems to think Republicans are okay with reducing this benefit, but could it hurt DeSantis and Trump in November?
You know, Zach, this is a landmine that gets bigger and more volatile the later we go and the closer we get to the election. Now, we're going to be talking about polls in a little bit. But so far, no poll has really asked this question. But you know, what you're looking at in Florida is that we've had, and if the governor said that they've got more than 1 million unique claims that they've paid out. So great, we're paying. We finally got this, quote unquote, the unemployment benefit system fixed. The problem is, starting very soon, people are going to have to make ends. Families will have to make ends meet on $275 a week. That's not going to go very far. The governor actually, on late Wednesday, the governor actually extended the moratorium on evictions for another month. That whole issue of not being able, having to choose between food and paying your rent is about to get a lot bigger, become a lot major issue for millions of Floridians who are still jobless. We know that the American Association, the trade group for the hoteliers, said the other day that across the country, only 37% of hotels in America have been able to hire at least half the staff they had before the pandemic. In Florida, you know how important hotels and the tourism industry is to low-wage workers in Florida. We're going, you know, when we get to November, nobody has polled this, but you kind of wonder if this could be one of the major pivots in how people vote. The idea that they were asked, this is a state where we had historically low 3% unemployment. The reason we have jobless individuals, not because, as Rick Scott says, people would rather stay home and get $275 a week and not have to work. The reason that they're without a job is because the government, the federal and state government, told the country and this state to shut down for good reason, to contain the spread of the coronavirus. They didn't give up their jobs willingly. They did it as part of a national effort for the public health of the country. And now they're being left on their own with $275 a week. I'm hearing this from people. Every time we've written at the Palm Beach Post, we've covered the whole jobless benefits issue. We've left no stone unturned, every angle of that story. And every time we write a story, we get inundated to the point where our reporters have to stop answering the phone. Wendy Rhodes, for example, had to stop answering the phones because so many people were calling, asking us for help. How do they navigate the system? And the last time this happened had to be maybe earlier this month. So even though this is not something that the governor is talking about at his daily briefings or that he's being questioned about at his daily briefings, it's still out there. It is still a major issue for people in this state. And I think when you get to November, this could be, we find out later on that this was the pivot point. That the fact that Floridians felt that they were left stranded on their own may be what the one of the major reasons, if not the major reason, of how they vote.
What do you think about Trump on this? I mean, it doesn't seem to help him at all to have people who are struggling to pay their bills, who are in desperate circumstances, who are who are really feeling the effects of this economy, and the person at the top tends to get the most blame. I've heard people say, Trump isn't really a fiscal conservative. He used to describe himself as the king of debt. He doesn't seem to buy into a lot of the Republican traditional sort of, that seems to be what is really delaying this latest relief package, is that a lot of Republicans are starting to, have concerns about continuing to add to the debt, in addition to this, concern that some have about whether this is a disincentive for work. But it is a very expensive program. Do you think the president could step in and basically say, hey, we're going to help people as much as possible before this election and try and throw his weight around in these negotiations?
Yes and no. Look, And I've said this before on this podcast, we're at the Palm Beach Post. We, from our building, you can see Mar-a-Lago. So for that reason, we cover this president and we watch him closer than I think any other news organization in the state. And I will say this about the president. I think the president understands this. I think the president understands this very well, that the number one issue right now in related to the pandemic, other than the public health consequences of people getting sick and almost 150,000, more than 150,000 Americans now dead, The other key measure of this is unemployment. Today, you know, this morning, the government reported a 32.5% economic GDP contraction in the second quarter. We have never seen anything like that, not in the Great Depression, not even in the 2008 financial crisis. The president knows it, but his response to this is not to go out to Capitol Hill and seek an extension of these jobless benefits. His reaction to this, his response has been all along, we're fine. We're done with coronavirus. We're going to get the economy going. We're going to talk about the economy. We're going to, you know, he's gone to different manufacturing sites that show that the economy is going again, and that has not worked. And it's been a colossal failure. You've seen that in the polls, which we'll be talking about in a little bit. But you've seen that just not work for him. It's been a colossal miscalculation. And in the last week or two, they've been trying to pivot. The White House has been trying to pivot, trying to make the argument that he's on top of this, that he's getting reengaged in the battle against coronavirus. And even that got undermined this week with this tweet of a video of this doctor. You know, we don't need to go into detail, but it was the so-called doctor. So his response is, yes. So that's why I say yes and no. Yes, he understands this, but no, because his response, the reaction, has not been to go out and battle to get more money into the hands of those who are unemployed. It has been to try to stress the economic reopening, that the coronavirus is behind us, that the worst is behind us. And he's had to admit that that's been a failure.
Right. And I guess if you're battling to get more money for the unemployed, you're sort of acknowledging that this disaster could go on for much longer and that we have to support people in the interim. It is sort of an acknowledgement that the coronavirus crisis is really still raging and devastating for people, and that they need more assistance. And then if you're acknowledging that the crisis is as bad as it is, it begs the question of, well, what are you doing to rein in the virus? What are you doing to stop this outbreak or to get it into a more manageable situation? And obviously, the president has taken a lot of criticism for that, that he hasn't taken the helm and really coordinated a federal response.
But he's also kind of locked in. He is governing from a party of small government conservatives, Tea Party conservatives, that do not want the federal government to take a larger role in aspects of American life. His own Rick Scott, a U.S. senator that he endorsed, that he even told, hey, Rick, run for U.S. Senate, makes the argument that giving these jobless assistance to people in need is a disincentive to work. So even if he, you know, wanted to get out there and seek this assistance, he's got a party that is rebelling against it.
Well, the economy and issues such as unemployment are certain to be a big concern for voters heading into the election, and they may be weighing down Trump here in Florida. A Quinnipiac University poll released last week had Joe Biden in the state by a whopping 13 percentage points. That seems highly unlikely in a state often decided by just a single percentage point. But every public poll released since April has shown Biden leading in Florida, including a Mason-Dixon poll released today that had Biden up by 4 percentage points. Biden leads Trump 50-46 in the Mason-Dixon poll with 4% undecided. One thing that stuck out to me about the poll, Antonio, is that just 37% of those polled had an unfavorable view of Biden, while 51% had an unfavorable view of Trump. The president has really never been extremely popular, but he was able to win in 2016 by making Hillary Clinton even less popular than him. This poll indicates he hasn't been able to do that with Biden so far here in Florida, at least. Antonio, why do you think Trump has had a tougher time defining Biden than Clinton?
Well, four reasons. One, Trump is running on a record. And that record right now that people are focused on is what we've been talking about, which is the pandemic. And it's been one that I think that he has really struggled, and people have seen him struggle, and many people have lost their jobs. Many others have gotten sick. In addition, this pandemic is impacting the one segment of the electorate, as we spoke about before, that is the most reliable set of voters, and that is older people. So that's the first reason. Second reason is Biden is not Hillary Clinton. You know, for all her accomplishments, Hillary Clinton went into the 2016 race with high negatives. You know, for whatever reason, people really just did not like her personally. Biden, on the other hand, has been historically pretty popular. And if you look in Florida, in fact, and this is a great barometer, if we go back to the beginning of the winter, you know, late fall, early winter, when Biden was in a tailspin in the Democratic race against 8 to 9 rivals still, when you got into November, December, even at the beginning of the primaries, you know, he lost badly in Iowa, lost badly in Nevada, lost badly in New Hampshire. Everybody was writing his political obituary. Even at that time, Zach, his polling in Florida was still very high. He still had a double-digit lead over Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, which were still the only two real legit rivals he had. Even when Michael Bloomberg jumped in the race, Biden still polled very well. So in Florida, you know, the fact that Biden is very, you know, even more popular than most places is problematic. That's the third reason. And finally, the fourth reason is that the pandemic is dominating the news cycle. And every time that Trump tries a different tact, some way to get at Biden, it is still overwhelmed by the news of the pandemic, by the daily briefings, the mounting illnesses, the infection rates, you know, the casualties, the number of Americans that are dead. That continues to really dominate the news cycle, dominate the conversation. And so his attacks, even ones that start really when he starts landing punches, as he's done with this one ad about defund the police and the phone call, you know, and the recording that, you know, press 5 if you've been raped. And even that ad that seemed to have that really landed a punch for whatever reason, even that doesn't have staying power because it's overwhelmed by the pandemic. So those four reasons, I think, explain why he's having a tough time trying to redefine Biden as somebody who would be unpalatable to voters.
And it's not just in Florida. He's been struggling in every key swing state. And now he comes out with a remarkable tweet today where he says, basically, we should delay the election. And he talks about, mail-in ballots and how he doesn't like mail-in ballots. And that basically he's saying that we should delay the election because of safety concerns about voting. What do you make of that?
Well, look, I think he's been talking this up. He's been setting the stage for calling for a delay in the election. This is something that he has been periodically calling for. And, you know,
do you think he's really concerned about the safety of voters, or is this him looking at polls like we just saw today in Florida?
Yeah, he's obviously not doing well. I mean, if he could delay it for a year and maybe by then there's a vaccine and the economy bounces back, then his fortunes were turned. Yeah, but I don't think it, first of all, let's get constitutional here. Number one, he can't delay it. It would take an act of Congress to change the date. The Democrats control the House of Representatives by a sizable majority. It's not going to happen. So number one, let's just put this, you know, let's bring reality back into this conversation. But number two, this has been his thing. He has been questioning, you know, the entire process. In fact, Tom Ridge, a Republican who served as George W. Bush's first Secretary of Homeland Security, earlier this week, he said he wonders if Trump is more worried about losing the election than election fraud. I mean, he's been questioning this, and he called on Trump to knock it off, to basically stop undermining the election. You know, if they're really that concerned about it, you know, the Congress and the Senate, the Republican-held Senate, should join the House that has already approved this and allocate more money for election systems. But, you know, the election's not going to be changed. And perhaps what he's thinking in his mind is that I can create it, get my, you know, the Trump base out there and, you know, and do what they did, you know, with the opening of the reopening of the economy, where these guys, these protesters would show up, and even the guys with the AK-47s and, you know, and really try to force the economy open, and maybe he can get this groundswell of support behind them to delay the election. But look, you know, elections were not delayed during the Civil War. They were not delayed during World War II. They were not delayed during the Great Depression. You know, the idea that all of a sudden in this pandemic, when you have the governor of Florida saying it's OK to send your kids to school, to now turn around and say, well, you know what, it's not safe enough to go vote. This is just not going to go very far.
And there's a lot of things you could do short of delaying the election. If you're concerned about the security of mail-in voting, you could take steps to make it more secure if that's an issue. You know, you could change the signature requirements. You could do other things. I mean, it is interesting. I mean, a lot of people might be confused about this because a lot of states did delay their primary elections because of concerns about the safety of voting. I remember Ohio, Florida didn't delay its election, which was controversial. I mean, we went forward with in-person voting in the primary in March, but a number of other states did. But it's a whole different ballgame, right, when you get to the actual general election.
It is. And again, the historic precedent that has been set is, 5 months after American troops landed at Normandy, and while they were getting ready to fight the Battle of the Bulge, we still had a presidential election. In the Civil War, in the summer of 1864, gruesome body counts, we still, in the fall of 1864, we still had an election. To now say, well, hold on a second, this pandemic is, and it's just creating too many problems, and we can't follow a tradition that the rest of the planet is looking at with hope and inspiration. We're going to I just don't see this happen.
It certainly ups the stakes and is something that we're going to be hearing more about going forward, I'm sure. Antonio, let's do some numbers here. You had 9.99. What's that all about?
Yeah, Zach, we've been talking so much about the pandemic and the politics. I thought, I'm going to do something really different this week. So 9.99 stands for $9.99. And that was the price of wild-caught fresh sockeye salmon at the Publix that I go to this morning. And the reason I'm pointing to this and I'm bringing this up is that earlier this month, the Army Corps of Engineers gave the green light, to the creation of the pebble mine, the controversial pebble mine in Alaska's Bristol Bay. And the idea they want to do is they want to mine for gold and copper and then build this entire road network to be able to transport that gold and copper and, in fact, even build a power plant to power this operation. And the reason what this has to do with sockeye salmon is that Bristol Bay, they want to build this mine and this power plant and these roads in the watershed, the headwaters of Bristol Bay, which is the network of streams and rivers in Alaska that supplies almost half of the wild-caught fresh salmon that is sold in the planet, not just the United States, but in the planet. So that sockeye salmon that sells for $9.99 at Publix this morning, 50% of the chance is that that sockeye salmon came from Bristol Bay. So once this mine goes into effect and they're mining and they're digging for gold and they're digging for copper and transporting and empowering it, it will disrupt the salmon fishery in Alaska. To what degree, we don't know. But it's a safe bet that within the next couple of years, if you see that sockeye salmon at Publix, fresh, wild caught, if you even see it, it may not even be there because the supply and demand rules don't change just because you built a power plant and a gold mine. It may cost you a lot more than $9.99. And I bring this up because so many times in our business, we get so hyper-local about our communities and what's going on that we forget that what happens sometimes on the other side of the continent will impact our pocketbooks, our diets, and our lifestyles. So I just want to throw that out there, something completely different.
Yeah, good reminder. I mean, this type of globalization and the protectionism and things like that, America First, are a big issue for the president and a big issue in this election, but a lot of this stuff is pretty hard to control. You're not gonna, you're not gonna get wild salmon in Florida. So in a lot of ways, there's no way to avoid these connections. So we're all kind of tied in together here on those things. Well, my number is 57. That is the number of coronavirus testing sites that are supported by the state of Florida that are going to shut down today because of the tropical storm Isaias that just formed actually this morning and is headed towards the state. It's just another reminder that despite all of the difficult coronavirus news going on right now, it is not the only thing that we have to worry about here in Florida. It is the heart. We're getting to the heart of hurricane season. We've already had a number of storms, and now Isaias is threatening the state. This is the first time the state has had to, I believe, shut down testing sites because of a tropical system. So it's not good timing. We're right in a point where this pandemic is raging. In Florida, it's important to have this testing and for public health officials to be able to identify who's infected and track down their contacts and try and limit the spread of this disease, and also to have an accurate picture of what's happening in Florida so that people can make appropriate decisions. So it's not ideal. Some people have said that these testing sites are being shut down for too long. The storm is not going to be threatening Florida until probably Saturday at the earliest. It looks like it's going to pass over the state on Sunday, probably, but we could start to feel tropical storm force winds earlier than that. But these are just tents, basically, in parking lots. So it is something that has to come down. People can argue about the length of shutting down these sites, but they are not appropriate. They are not hurricane resistant here. They would blow away. So, it's unfortunate timing and a reminder for everybody that coronavirus is not the only threat that we face in this state right now. Well, that wraps up another episode of Inside Florida Politics. I want to thank our audio production team of Thomas Cordy, Joseph Rosano. Thanks to all of you for listening. Stay safe. We're out of here.